Tonight's sermon did not begin its life as a sermon. Instead, it began its life as a commencement address that I was asked to give a few years ago at Faulkner University in Montgomery, Alabama. But like most graduation addresses, I don't think they're very good if they can't be turned into a sermon. So I guess we'll find out tonight about the one I gave. Particularly now, since this is graduation season, so that might also make it timely. I remember in writing that commencement address that I was struggling with what to say. I'd never given one before. I'd heard a few, but I'd never given one. Should I talk about the exciting world of electrical engineering or the equally exciting world of patent law? Or maybe just give them some of those wise principles of life that are so popular this time of year, those Benjamin Franklin-like platitudes that you hear in many graduation addresses. Never eat more than you can lift. They can't chase you if you don't run. If the enemy is in range, so are you. But none of those seemed quite right, so I struggled with, you know, what to find a topic worthy of the occasion. What should I choose? How should I decide what to say? And with those questions, I found my topic. I decided to talk to the graduating seniors about decisions. So much of our life depends upon the choices that we make and the decisions that we make. How do we make those choices? How should we make those choices? You hear much today about freedom of choice. And it's true, God has given us free will. We have the power to choose. But while we have the power to choose our actions, we are not free to choose the consequences of those actions. In fact, a true mark of wisdom is the ability to anticipate those consequences. Our God-given right to choose is a God-given responsibility to choose wisely, make wise decisions. You often hear of the pathway of life. It's often talked about a lot in commencement addresses. But for many, there is no pathway at all. There's just a dark forest with countless paths leading off in countless different directions. And in fact, at no time in history have we had more choices available to us than we do right now, today. And the more choices we have, the more difficult it is to make decisions and to choose wisely. Seems like today we can do what we want, we can do where we want, we can do with whom we want, all sorts of choices that we have. Some decisions are very big, some seem very small. But at the time, it's not always easy to tell which is which, is it? A lot of times we'll look back at decisions that seemed very small at the time that turned out to be life-changing. That uncertainty makes it all the more important that we choose wisely and that we have some basis to use when making those decisions. And there are many bases from which we could choose to make our decisions. We could decide just to do what others are doing. It's very popular these days. We could decide to do what feels right or what feels good, also very popular. We could just do nothing, but even that is a decision, isn't it? And there are many on that path today. The world is full of people that just can't make up their mind about anything. Winston Churchill described such people as decided only to be undecided, resolved to be irresolute, and adamant for drift. For that drifting group, nothing is deliberate. Instead, life for them is just a game of pinball, and they get bounced around through life, and suddenly they miss a paddle, they drop through the chute, and that's the end of that. They don't care what path they're on because they don't care where they're going. I remember when I was preparing those graduation remarks, I came across a poem by Robert Frost, long been a favorite of mine, and again, it's a very popular poem in graduation addresses, The Road Not Taken. And that poem is all about making choices, and it ends with the memorable line, "Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by." And that has made all the difference. And that line has no doubt been quoted in countless graduation exercises to tell countless graduates, all dressed exactly alike, that individuality is the key to success. But when you read the entire poem, I think what you find is that it has a very different message. The poem begins with a description of these two roads that diverged in a yellow wood, but the poet tells us they were about the same. If one was really less traveled, it was hardly noticeable to him at the time. It was only many years later in the poem, he says ages and ages hence, that he concluded that one of them must have been less traveled. And he does so, he says, with a sigh. There really was, he concludes, a basis for that decision he made so long ago. The decision that seemingly made such a difference in his life. Surely the course of his life had not been determined by a random choice in the woods. Or had it? When you read the entire poem, what you find is that it's not about individualism at all. It's about regret. It's about regret. After all, the title of the poem is not The Less Traveled Road. The title of the poem is The Road Not Taken. The great philosopher Yogi Berra said, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." And we all come upon many forks in the road. And we're often called to make a decision. Do I go left? Do I go right? Maybe I should turn around and go back? How can I know which way to go? We ask questions like that many times in our lives, and absent guidance, we may, like that poet, find ourselves one day just filled with regret about the seeming randomness of life. When we come to one of those forks in the road, how do we know which path to take? What we need are road signs, road signs. And that's what I want us to briefly look at here tonight. Three road signs that will help us on that road, help us determine which way to go. Three guideposts that will help us find our way through that dark forest. Three choices that we're going to face not once but many times, and that we've already faced many times. The first road sign presents us with a choice between truth and desire. Truth and desire. There are ultimately only two real philosophies of life. Only two. A philosophy that conforms desire to truth, or a philosophy that conforms truth to desire. As Christians, we know that desire must be in submission to the truth. But the worldly reality is that truth and desire are almost always on a collision course in our world today. And what happens when that collision occurs? Do we conform our desires to the truth, or do we twist the truth to conform it to our desires? That conflict is a very ancient one. Think about Eve. She knew the truth, and yet she was standing before what in Genesis 3:6? A tree to be desired. A tree to be desired. She knew the truth, but she was standing before a tree to be desired. What to do? She ate the fruit. She ate the fruit. But she did more than that, didn't she? She also believed the serpent and was deceived. When faced with a conflict between truth and desire, she chose desire, and then she twisted her view of the truth to match that desire. How many times in history has that bad decision been repeated? Jesus faced that same choice in the first temptation in the wilderness, didn't he? And Paul was talking about that same choice in Galatians 5:24, when he said, "Those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and what? Its desires." That's the battle between truth and desire. That verse describes the conflict between truth and desire, and it tells us the outcome of that conflict for those who belong to Christ. When you see truth and desire on that road sign, choose the way of truth. It may not be the pleasant way, it may not be the easy way, but it's the right way. The second road sign presents us with a choice between one and many. One and many. I remember I told those graduates that day that if I could leave them with only one piece of advice, it would be this: live a focused life in this unfocused world and you'll succeed. Our focus is the laser beam that cuts through the fog of mediocrity that's engulfing this world. And that's not just a message to graduates, that's a message to all of us, isn't it? God demands our focus. When we look at those who have accomplished much in this world, what we see is focus. We just spoke about the Apostle Paul. He certainly understood the power of focus. He wrote, "But one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead. I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus," Philippians 3, 13 and 14. He had a goal. He was focused on that goal. "This one thing I do," he wrote. A Christian life is a focused life. Indeed, a successful life in any area is a focused life. As a patent attorney, I have a special appreciation for Thomas Edison. Over his career, he filed 1,700 patents in the U.S., 1,200 foreign. In 1 year alone, he filed over 100 successful patent applications. A great inventor and a dream client. A reporter once camped outside his office for 3 weeks hoping to get an interview with Thomas Edison. When he finally met Edison, he asked him the secret of his success. And Edison said, "The secret to success is the ability to apply your physical and mental energies to one problem incessantly without growing weary." "You do something all day long, don't you?" he asked. "Everyone does. If you get up at 7 and go to bed at 11, you've put in 16 good hours. And it's certain with most men, they've been doing something all that time. The only trouble is that they do it about a great many things, and I do it about one thing," he said. "If they took the time in question and applied it in one direction to one object, they would succeed." Edison understood the power of focus, the choice between the one and the many. Focus is vital, yet nothing is more difficult in our modern world. Our world of buzzing iPhones and blaring televisions and endless distractions, focus prevents us from being sidetracked by all that noise. Focus keeps us on track when the pathways are leading off in every direction. Focus keeps us on the pathway toward our goal. Spiritual focus is a primary theme in the book of James. Is that a surprise? No. James grew up with Jesus. He understood. He had personally witnessed the focus of Christ. He personally had seen that. And James tells us, "Draw nigh to God and he will draw nigh to you. Purify your hearts, you double-minded," in James 4, verse 8. Notice how James links our purity of heart with our spiritual focus. Those who choose the many over the one, they're double-minded, James says. And those who are double-minded are not pure in heart, James tells us. But didn't Jesus tell us the exact same thing? "Blessed are the pure in heart." Why? "For they shall see God." They shall see God. Matthew 5, 8. Blessed are those who focus on God because, why? They shall see Him. The message is simple. We see what we focus on. And that brings us to our final road sign. The third road sign presents us with a choice between the seen and the unseen. We just talked about the power of focus. A natural question is, where should we direct that focus? Focus by itself is not a virtue. You could be the most focused person in the world, but if you're focused on the wrong thing, it's not going to do you any good. Upon what should we focus? And God answers that question with a wonderful paradox. We should focus on what we cannot see. We live in a secular world that rejects the unseen. Most people focus on the seen because they think that's all there is. And that's not just a modern phenomenon. Why was the rich fool in Luke 12 a fool? Because he focused only on what he could see, ignoring the unseen. And why was Moses such a pillar of the faith in Hebrews 11? Well, Hebrews 11:1 tells us why. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. And Moses looked to his unseen reward rather than to the riches in Egypt. Again, it's the Apostle Paul who perfectly frames the issue for us. We do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, the things which are not seen are eternal. 2 Corinthians 4:18. Helen Keller once said, "It gives me a deep, comforting sense that things seen are temporal and things unseen are eternal." And Helen Keller also said, "To be blind is bad, but worse is to have eyes and not see." And that's true of so many today. They have eyes, but they cannot see. Don't be like them. Choose the unseen. Choose the permanent. At some point in our lives, we're all going to look up and wonder where we're headed in this life. The answer to that question is simple. If you want to know where you're headed, look at the road you're on. No one who gets on Interstate 10 in Houston and heads west should be surprised when they eventually end up in San Antonio. And yet people often react with surprise when they reach the destination to which their decisions and their choices have naturally led them. The key to reaching the right destination is to get on the right road in the right direction and stay on that right road. And the people on that road choose truth over desire. They choose one over many. They choose the unseen over the seen. They look for those road signs, and they choose their path with deliberation and with wisdom. The first time I gave this talk, those coming forward got a diploma. Tonight, you can come forward and receive something infinitely more valuable. You can put on your Lord in baptism for the remission of sins and receive the gift of eternal life. You will never make a more important decision than that. If we can help you in any way, please come while we stand and while we sing.